TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Israeli strikes on Gaza kill hundreds. Francesca Albanese reacts to the breach of the ceasefire. She is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories. She was in London when Israel broke the ceasefire in Gaza on March 18, 2025, and killed more than 400 people in that first night. She was being interviewed on Channel 4 News on the topic of genocide. And I'm presenting this half hour with minimal edits to show how many challenges an interviewer needs to build into the exchange in order to avoid the accusation of anti-Semitism. This interview, just a week later, had over 250,000 views.
And welcome to The Forecast. I'm Krishnan Gurumurthy. My guest this week is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Palestinian Occupied Territories, Francesca Albanese. She is an Italian lawyer who for the last 3 years has held this UN appointment, but she is persona non grata in Israel, and so is not allowed to travel there. She's a very controversial figure in Israel. As we speak, Israel has broken the ceasefire. Overnight, there was a massive bombing campaign, possibly the biggest single loss of life since early on in the war after the October 7th attacks. And let's begin with that. What's your reaction to what has happened overnight?
Hi, thanks for having me. First of all, it's not that Israel broke the ceasefire last night. Israel has just killed around 400 people, and this is the acceleration of not a war, of the genocide that is happening in real time. And it has been happening for the past 6 months. Between 45,000 and 50,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. And as we speak, Israel has ordered the evacuation of the Palestinians in Gaza, which means that the aggression is going to continue. This is a military strategy aiming to ethnically cleanse what remains of Palestine, and if the Palestinians do not move voluntarily, this is what waits for them.
We'll come to your use of the word genocide and why you concluded that in a moment. But what I want to ask you precisely about the legality of what is going on now, because Israel says it is targeting Hamas terrorists, and it says that anybody else killed is a regrettable byproduct of war. Now, what is the legality of what they are doing if they are indeed targeting people they regard as Hamas?
Let's pause for a second, Krishnan. 18,000 children being a regrettable outcome of war, it stinks as a lie. And let me tell you, 500 years of settler colonial history have been supported by this kind of arguments that there is always someone who's barbarians as a terrorist. Again, I do not want to downplay the risks that Israel has faced or might still face, but nothing justifies a genocide. And the destruction of life that has taken place over the last 16 months in Gaza, all schools, all hospitals, farming land, and most of the houses. What is this? Why did Israel had to do that? In another situation, would you call a state that hits intentionally and voluntarily hospitals, that starves an entire defenseless population, because this is what it is, would you call it an outcome of war?
It's your use of the word intentionally there that Israel disputes, isn't it? That they say they are not intentionally hitting civilian targets.
What are they
doing?
Are
intentionally hitting Hamas targets. So what is the legal? And that's how they say everything we're doing is legal. So what is your legal analysis of that?
Okay. The legal analysis is then, let's assume that it's a conflict, right? In a conflict, there are rules. And there are a principle of military necessity that Israel claims to have. Well, it is to provide evidence. It is to take precautions. It is to respect the principle of proportionality in every action it takes. How is it possible that in 16 months, it has killed 50,000 people and leveled to the ground the entire Gaza Strip? Very little remains, not enough to resume life. Again, this is not the first time that a power justifies its action, its devastation, in terms of self-defense or in terms of an action motivated by annihilating the terrorists. This is not the point, but there are rules to spare life, to preserve the sanctity of life, and there are obligations. Look, again, this is not debatable. I mean, my intention is not to debate whether it's genocide or not. This is past. We have failed to prevent genocide, and it's not just me saying that. The entire human rights community, there is a wall-to-wall consensus that Israel is committing genocide. Like 2 years ago, there was a wall-to-wall consensus that Israel was maintaining an apartheid regime. And I take it that it's very sensitive for politicians to deal with it. But there are two Israeli leaders who are wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including starvation. So even if we don't go to genocide analysis, why member states like the UK have not honored their international obligations to intervene and stop crimes, including because in January 2024, the International Court of Justice, 3 months into this military assault, had concluded that there was a plausibility of risk of genocide.
Okay, so let's explain your conclusion that mm-hmm. this is genocide.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think most people think, well, it's not up to you to decide that this is genocide, it's up to a court of law. But so can you walk me towards your conclusion?
But that's not true. That's not true, because otherwise we would... Okay, let me start from the beginning. So, because I understand, look, it's... I want to also talk about my journey, because I was not convinced at all that it was genocide. I've been probably among all special rapporteurs, I've been the most reluctant to use that term. And it has taken me weeks to do that because and many Western people, for me, genocide was the Holocaust or Rwanda with very specific industrial characteristics. But let me tell you, genocide is not defined by personal opinions or historical precedents. What constitutes genocide is that it's established at Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, which defines the intentional destruction, which is intended as physical or biological destruction of a group as such through acts of killing, infliction of severe bodily or mental harm, or prevention of birth, or the creation of conditions of life calculated to destroy. And there is a quite scant jurisprudence, but very effective, to argue that this genocide can be understood as the totality of crimes and actions that Israel has taken against the Palestinians as such. Because again, I understand that Israel keeps on saying, I've been targeting Hamas, but it's not true, because in fact, it has targeted indiscriminately the Palestinian population in Gaza. And let me give you an example. Since October, I've been documenting what has happened in terms of killing, destruction of hospitals, schools, this total siege that has been declared over Gaza, because let's not forget, on the first day after October 7, the former Minister of Defense, who's wanted by the ICC for war crimes and crimes against humanity, said, we are dealing with human animals, and they will have no water, no food, no medicine, no electricity. This was already, for many, the expression of genocidal intent. And this leads to the application of the genocide framework. You know why I dispute what you are saying, which is the sentiment of many, so it's, of course, I understand, is that the Genocide Convention has three obligations: to prevent, to stop, and then to punish genocide. So the court intervenes on that last obligation. But how do we prevent genocide if we don't see that happening? And this is the question. We have already failed to prevent genocide. And really, for the benefit of your audience, I would like to say this is not my analysis only. There are over 30 special rapporteurs from different realms of international law denouncing this as genocide. The most prominent Israeli genocide historians and scholars have documented this and denounced that this is genocide. Amnesty International has put out a report of hundreds of pages saying that it's genocide. The reason why, you know, I'm quite frustrated right now is that I spend the night looking at what was happening in Gaza, where 400 people, I've seen bodies of children being collected from the walls. You know, I'm tired of seeing bodies of people hanging from the walls as you and I in our homes have our coats. This is to stop. Okay, even if you don't want to think that it's genocide, let's make use of what the International Court of Justice has said in January 2024. There is a plausible risk of genocide. Therefore, Israel must stop conducting the military assault as it's doing. It must allow humanitarian aid to enter. And a few months later, it has also reminded member states who have an obligation to prevent genocide, so they cannot use, but there is no court decision. Let me tell you, most genocides have been recognized as not through courts. The Aboriginal of Australia, the Native Americans in the US, the indigenous First Nation, Métis and Inuit in Canada. There is no court that has established that there was a genocide, and this is my fear. Here, we have the opportunity to stop it, and we are not doing that because we are debating whether there is genocide or not.
So come again to the question of intent.
Krishnan, let me ask you, because again, I find this question puzzling, but I understand that you come really from an honest and candid point of wanting to explain to people at home what is intent. What do you understand by intent? What do people at home think that intent is? Something invisible, that it's in the heart of the politicians or the leaders? I don't think that there is another case where the genocidal, the destructive intent is as obvious, as documented, as proven, as declared over and over as this one. Excuse me, they have said it. I mean, they were saying destroy the Hamalek, the mother, the children, the donkey and the camel, like 16 months ago. And now they're saying open the gate of hell. And then it's not just the words spoken, which debatably could be an indication of an intent to destroy. The intent to destroy is not the reason why. This is a motive, and in international criminal law, this has another value. Intent is the determination to destroy. And it's made of intentions, clearly, but it's made of policy decisions, structures. There is a structure in place. There is a chain of command where the words spoken have been amplified at every chain of the Israeli army. And all the more, they have been enacted.
Was October the 7th, the attack, an act of genocide? Or did it have genocidal intent?
I don't think so, but it was the war crimes were committed against Israelis. There is no doubt about that.
So what's the difference?
The difference is the intent to destroy a people as such.
Is that not clearly what they were trying to do on October the 7th?
So
weren't they just killing anybody they saw?
Look at the interesting posture you are taking here. You are questioning me on whether 16 months of assault on a population where the 70% of the victims have steadily been women and children from October 2023 to March 2025, the victims in Gaza have steadily been women and children, and still you ask me to prove, to give you the evidence of genocide. But
I'm asking you about what your analysis is of October, because you're very clear that what's happened after October the 7th is genocide. I'm asking you, are you clear that what happened on October the 7th and the Hamas incursion into Israel and killing whoever they came across, was that an attempt at genocide?
Whatever it was, it doesn't justify.
I'm not asking you that.
I'm just telling you, in
terms of the act itself.
I don't think it was an act of genocide. It was despicable, it was inhumane, it was criminal to the extent it hit civilians, and it has been also documented by the Commission of Inquiry, who has investigated what has happened inside Israel. And I'm not going to question that. I've condemned the killing of Israeli civilians from the very first moment, and so the abduction of civilians. But whatever the reason why I'm saying that is that since the very first hours, there have been people in Israel saying, we have been victims of a genocide, which has been used with all the misinformation that has followed to portray the Palestinians as an existential threat for what they had allegedly supported happening on October 7, and therefore justifying the brutal, revengeful response that had happened. But this is the beauty of international law, that the Genocide Convention says whatever the reason, whatever self-defense, even self-defense doesn't justify a genocide.
Yeah, no, that's a separate question as to what justifies it. I'm just asking you in terms of what happened. You're clear it was war crimes, it was illegal. What you've also said in the past is that there is a right to resist.
Of course.
So just explain, what is, you know, do you see what happened as October the 7th as resistance, or was it straightforwardly war crimes, illegal and terrible?
I'm glad you're asking this question because I think there is so much confusion. So in international law, people who are under oppression and under foreign domination have a right to resist. And this is similar to what a state has as self-defense. So state have their sovereignty. So state that exist have to be protected in their sovereign space. And if they are threatened by another state, they have the right to use war, to use force in the form of self-defense. A people have a right of self-determination, so a right to exist as a people in a given land. Therefore, when they are oppressed, when they have to protect the right of self-determination.
So that means Hamas has the right to fight
people,
within Gaza.
No. Again, you are taking me to a space which is not the right framework, because you are talking of Gaza as if it was a standalone entity. No, Krishnan. The Palestinian people have the exclusive, recognized right of self-determination in the little that remains of their land, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, which Israel is unlawfully occupied. And let me remind the audience that in July last year, the International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to withdraw its presence from the occupied Palestinian territory entirely, totally and unconditionally, the military presence, to dismantle the settlements and to stop controlling the Palestinian natural resources. This is an obligation that has implications also for the UK, which means there shouldn't be any recognition of what Israel does in the occupied Palestinian territory as legal, including the exercise of what you are calling self-defense. This is the law. And there is also an obligation not to do anything that results in aiding and assisting the occupation. Krishnan, this is the discussion we need to have, because this is the framework in which, yes, the Palestinian as a people have under international law the right to defend themselves, to resist as a way to defend themselves as a people, which have limitations.
Yeah, but what does that mean civilians in terms of actual action? So when Hamas fires rockets, is that an act of self-defense, or is this, as Israel portrays it, an act of terrorism?
Yeah, of course Israel portrays it as an act of terrorism. Israel has the obligation to withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territory. And if once this happened, it's attacked by the state of Palestine, it has the sacrosanct right to invoke and use the right of self-defense.
So to be clear then, on those rocket attacks, are you saying they are legal resistance?
I'm not saying anything that International Court of Justice has not said already for the past 20 years. Israel cannot invoke the self-defense against the people it occupies.
No, you're talking about what Israel's doing. I'm talking about what Hamas is doing. Mm. Is what Hamas does when it fires a rocket at an Israeli town, is that, in your terms, self-defense, or is it terrorism?
It can be both. If you target civilians, it can be both. So again, an act of resistance.
Well, those rocket attacks are untargeted, largely.
Look, an act of resistance can be criminal and therefore should be held accountable. So those who have committed crimes against any civilians through killing, brutalization, torture, or abduction need to be held accountable. But let me tell you, under international law, an unlawful act of the resistance doesn't delegitimize the resistance, while the occupation that Israel maintains in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem is so unlawful, the taints of illegality, whatever it does, and it's not defensible. As the Court of Justice has reminded Israel, in many ways, the only legal way for Israel to exercise self-defense vis-a-vis the Palestinians is to withdraw its military and civilian presence from the occupied Palestinian territory and give the Palestinians an opportunity to live free as a people, and cannot justify the legitimate security risks that it faces to annihilate the Palestinians. So this is what's happening, Krishnan.
You are listening to an interview of Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine. She was interviewed on Channel 4 News in London on the day Israel broke the ceasefire. This program has minimal edits to show how many challenges an interviewer needs to build into the exchange in order to avoid the accusation of anti-Semitism.
So what should the United Nations, the organization you work for, and international governments be doing now to stop what's going on?
As an independent expert of the United Nations, I can tell you that I can't remember another historical phase where the United Nations have been so fragmented and paralyzed. There is the legal component that has failed because no one has firmly reminded Israel that self-defense, I mean, other than in the Global South, but the organization as such should challenge the way Israel and Western states in particular interpret self-defense. Self-defense is something that has limits. Self-defense can be invoked in two circumstances, when it's authorized by the Security Council or when it's a direct response to an attack or threat of an attack by another state. So not against a people maintained under occupation. This is the first thing. There has been a failure for the international community that is represented as the United Nations to work as a platform to prevent conflict and then to resolve conflict. The question of Palestine has been treated as a humanitarian issue to deal with in perpetuity. Instead of, it's very easy to end the question of Palestine in line with international law. Instead, what the General Assembly has been turned into is kicking the can in the air, thanks to the influence of Western states, powerful Western states, which are kept on saying there should be peace, there should be peace. But how can there be peace?
I mean, the truth is the UN is broken now, isn't it? I mean,
it's not broken. It's wounded. And the point is that this is, for me, the silver lining is that this is an opportunity for a new reorganization of forces. It's the time of, in a way, we are breaking the silence of what is happening in the occupied Palestinian territory. 2 years ago, it would have been impossible to talk of Israel as an apartheid state, imposing racial segregation. Now we do, because the International Court of Justice has said that. It would have been impossible to debate in TV whether Israel was committing acts of genocide or not. And now we do that also because there are Israeli leaders for the first time indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Now we need to break the silos. We need to work as an international community able to take us away from this abyss and start working, recognizing all of us as equal. This is not happening, Krishnan.
Can I ask about you? Because you are also targeted by Israel supporters who accuse you of coming to this job with bias, of previous positions on Israel. In some cases, they accuse you of anti-Semitism, straightforwardly. What do you think is going on there, and what is your response to it?
First of all, let's clarify with this job, because this is something I'm doing voluntarily and really out of principle, because as a European, as a responsible European person, I'm so deeply, quintessentially against racism and violence, explicitly because our ancestors have been part of the genocide of the Jewish people, the Roma and Sinti, and all the genocides that have been committed against colonial
people. But did you come to this job with an open mind?
Of course, of course. But open mind doesn't mean empty mind. I mean, I've produced a scholarship on the question of Palestine, so I'm knowledgeable. I'm very knowledgeable. If this is a liability, well, for whom? I mean, again, I wouldn't exaggerate the criticism against me, because I keep on being in very respected and very well received by most governments in the world, and most importantly, including by the people in the West. Frankly, the fact that certain leaders don't want to meet me, I understand. I mean, I expect that people who are accused of complicity with war crimes and crimes against humanity and possibly genocide take an issue with me. But
does the British government receive you?
Not that I recall in the last 16 months. But it's important that the British people listen to this and take an issue eventually with the British government. Because I say there is willful blindness and ignorance vis-a-vis the facts that have taken place and the legal qualifications thereof. Because my job as a special rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory, I am mandated by the United Nations Human Rights Council to document and report the violations of international law that takes place in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. So this is also to qualify what you were asking me about October 7, that has been investigated by a commission of inquiry, which is deeply, deeply antagonized by your government. So whatever we say is not listened to. It's very convenient. But let me tell you what my job requires from me. I'm required to be impartial, to document the facts objectively, and to assess them according to the applicable legal framework, which is humanitarian law, international human rights law, and the other conventions that are a complement to the human rights system. Once I've made my conclusions, it's not up to me to strive for equidistance among the parties, because here there are no parties. There is an unlawful occupier and an occupied people in perpetuity. There is a state that continues to advance what has the hallmark of settler colonial practices, and it's committing international crimes.
I'm not going to go into some of the history. I mean, you have apologized for talking about the Jewish lobby in the past, and you've never used it again. So we don't need to go into that necessarily here. I just want to ask you finally, you're the subject of threats right now.
As anyone who speaks out on the question of Palestine today, which includes many Jewish people, and anyone else. So it's, I'm in good company, let me tell you.
Do you feel, A, it's worth it, and B, you're achieving anything right now?
I don't know, worth is not the first word that comes to my mind.
Well, your personal security is in jeopardy right now, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm asking myself, I have two young children. So my answer is, no one in my life is more important than anyone else, including you, Krishnan. So if you were in Gaza with your family, you would be very happy to have someone like me taking risk, because you would be seen, at least. So worth is not exactly the word that comes to mind. It's a moral imperative. It's a moral call. This is what being cognizant of of being part of humanity means to me in its simplest way. And again, I think there is no alternative to me. It's coming at great cost, at great risk, and at the same time, when I have the opportunity, I can sleep with a clear light conscience. I wonder how leaders, including in this country, look at their children these days, have their meals, buy their things on Amazon or whatever. How can you carry out your life thinking that you have the power to stop it, and you're not doing that?
Francesca Albanese, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
You heard Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. She was interviewed in London on Channel 4 News by Krishnan. Please find this program on YouTube under the title Israeli Strikes on Gaza Kill Hundreds. Francesca Albanese Reacts. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.